when it comes to people of integrity in the Old Testament, do we come up with the same people? No, you don't come up with the people, the same people. You say, well, the whole message of the gospel is justification by faith. So you mentioned Abraham, David. But who in the Old Testament are people of integrity? Daniel. We'll look at Daniel. Who else? Joshua. All right. Job. Enoch. Joseph. That's about it, I think. There may be some other minor characters. But those were men of integrity, and they're not mentioned in the same way about being justified by faith. We're talking about Christian integrity. Now, if there's a definition of integrity, I'm going to make my own definition here. It's something with no holes in it. I mean, when you speak of the integrity of a ship's hull, it means there aren't any leaks. Or the integrity of a watertight compartment system, it means that everything fits. There are no compromises. There are no breaks. So we speak of Christian integrity. It's something that's not normally spoken of just because we are a culture, a Christian culture, and maybe rightly so, that assumes that everybody doesn't have it, and consequently they need to be forgiven. But having been forgiven, having received grace, the missing ingredient in the Christian culture and in the Christian church and in the Christian family is integrity. Integrity would go along with such things as keeping your marriage vows. That's integrity. Integrity would go along with not sliding over things on your income tax return. Integrity would have to... Well, you two better get together. A banker and accountant here. Okay. Integrity would have to do with your word of honor, or what we'd call your word of honor. Have to do with handshakes. It'd have to do with keeping your word, whether it was under oath or not under oath. And Jesus spoke of it as not under oath. James speaks of it as not under oath. Let your yea be yea and your nay, nay. He's talking about integrity. When you said it, that's the way it is. You don't have to put your left hand in the Bible and raise your right hand and swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. But if you did, then you ought to keep it. But you should be able to say something, and that's the way it is. Many years ago, when I was a young man, I heard Dawson Trotman say this. He said he overheard his two of his boys talking. And the older son said to the younger son, don't believe Dad when he tells you he's going to take you someplace. He told me he'd take me for a pony ride once, and he never has. The older son was teaching the younger son that his father couldn't be trusted to keep his word. We're on the subject of integrity. We just mentioned briefly so far that the people in the New Testament that are mentioned in the New Testament are from the Old Testament, Abraham, David, are people who are justified by faith. And then I ask the question, are these the same people that we would say were men of integrity from the Old Testament? And the answer seemed to be pretty clearly no. And I asked for the people who were men of integrity and came up with Daniel and Job and Joseph and Joshua and Enoch and maybe somebody else. People of integrity. And it doesn't mean they were without sin. It just meant that they were primarily known for keeping their word, primarily known for staying on track, whatever they did. They just went with it and kept going that way. So I'm not speaking now of men of integrity who are non-Christians, although there are such men. People who look askance at Christians because the Christians aren't men of integrity. And some of these people are. I have a dear friend who's a missionary in Europe and Germany, but he first went to China. He also has radio programs in Yugoslavia, and he first was in Kunming in southwest China. And then he was a missionary in Japan when that closed, and then finally went to Germany. But one of the things he told me when we were both in Japan, this. He said he made a point of never doing business with Christians, because on the whole, Christians took advantage of the fact that you were also a Christian. He said, if I have some printing to do, some posters to be made, something to put around Tokyo advertising a meeting or a gospel, something, and I go to have it proofread, and they didn't have it, save it for me to proof it. They just printed it, and there's a mistake in it. And the Christian printer said, well, we're both Christians, there's grace. But he said, if I go to a non-Christian printer, he knows if he doesn't correct that thing, he's just lost future business. His sense of business is going to make him do it right. And the Christian is taking advantage that you're also a Christian. And I remember that, saying that he made a point of not doing business with Christians because the non-Christians knew their business counted on them being doing it right. And that doesn't mean there aren't cheats out there. I suppose some of you have read the books on the, what's it called? In Search of Excellence, Pursuit of Excellence, something like that. And it reads like something ought to come out of the New Testament. And they point to the groups that do it right, whether it be IBM or Frito-Lay or McDonald's or whatever. They insist on quality, they insist on politeness, they insist on graciousness, they insist on everything. Pizza Hut, same sort of thing. And they're doing it just because it's money in their pocket. They just figured out it works. Now, I'm not saying we should do things that way. That's why it's entitled Christian Integrity. We are not putting an emphasis on that. We're putting an emphasis on grace, and grace is something, as we perceive it, is something that picks up the pieces and puts them back together again. We do not think of grace as something that helps us be honest. Advanced preemptive grace, preventative grace, grace that is available before you sin. Okay, there's something else about this whole business of integrity. It can be and should be taught to children as they grow up, even before they're Christians. The standard of the law doesn't change. The moral law doesn't change pre-Christian and post-Christian. It just doesn't stay. It's the same. The non-Christian cannot keep it like a Christian can, but he should still be taught it. And I have it's a two-edged sword for the non-Christian. It makes him feel guilty when he's not doing it, and it shows him his need of grace. But with the Christian, the moral law has a different function. Let me just read from the book of Romans the function of the law from several portions. And I'm not really talking about law and grace. I am talking about integrity. And integrity is the ultimate of honesty and continued honesty. Romans 3:20. Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in his sight by observing the law. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of sin. Okay, that's one of the functions of the law. We become conscious of sin. Let's look at Romans 5:20. The law was added so that the trespass might increase. But where sin increased, grace increased all the more. So the second function of the law was to increase the trespass. One is to make you conscious of sin, and next to make you super conscious of sin with more trespasses. You've heard me say this before, but if I say, Johnny, don't touch Susie's toys, what does that mean? It increases the trespass. He touches Susie's toys. All right. And 7, Romans 7, Verse 7, what shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. Indeed, I would not have known what sin was except through the law, for I would not have known what it was to covet if the law had not said, do not covet. And verse 13, by no means, but in order that sin might be recognized as sin, it produced death in me through what was good, so that through the commandment sin might become utterly sinful. So we see that the trespass increases with the law, and it people are conscious of their utter sinfulness of sin. Post-Christian, post-conversion, it has a different function. Romans 8:3. For what the law was powerless to do, in that it was weakened by the sinful nature. In other words, the law could not make you be good. Could not keep you alive, and couldn't keep you from being bad. What the law could not do, God did, by sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful man to be a sin offering. What the law could not do, the cross could do. And so he condemns sin and sinful man in order that the righteous requirements of the law might be fully met in us, who do not live according to the sinful nature, but according to the Spirit. The law gave the standard. Sin increased. The trespass increased. People were conscious of sin, and more sin. The law couldn't keep you alive, and couldn't make you obey it. But what the law could not do, the cross could do. Yes?
Is the penalty of the law included when they refer to the law? Because it seems to me like the law is not in the position of enforcing righteousness, but rather the penalty of the law is, or fear of the penalty, is
right.
The thing that enforces it.
Certainly in this, it doesn't mention it here. It doesn't mention it here.
But, you know, you go back and you read Levitical law, and there's also, here's the standard, but here's the
consequences of it.
So, when they refer to law in general.
But you see two kinds of penalties in the books of the law. You see the penalty for a criminal code, like death, Exodus 21, and you see the sacrificial. You see the religious, you see both there. I didn't want to dwell on that right now. I wanted to point out that what the cross did, the righteous requirements of the law can be fully met in us. Okay? They cannot be fully met in a non-Christian. They can be fully met in us because of the cross. Therefore, Christians can have integrity. Christians can be honest. And it's possible to have this because of the cross. We have thought of the cross, though, as something that takes care of Abraham and David, but not something that makes Joseph's and Daniel's. Okay. We think of the cross as something that saves by grace, but doesn't make godly by grace. I was going to back up and make cases for each of these people, but remember what Job's wife said on the second set of. She said, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." You know, you're still holding on to your integrity, and the temptation is great to bag it, throw it out. I mentioned two examples, Dawson Troutman speaking of his son, and Bill Pape saying he didn't want to do business with Christians because he couldn't trust Christians. Now, he was not a cynic. He's very much of a realist, and he just knew that he'd get... But there are other cases of lack of integrity, and that has to do with how we deal with people. Let's suppose you have to fire somebody and you give two different stories. You give the story to the person you're firing and you give another story to your boss or to the other people in the workplace. Well, say if it's not somebody you have to fire, let's suppose it's a church situation where the pastor has been immoral. And the elders find out about it and don't tell the church, but tell him he has to resign. So he resigns, and they write him a glowing recommendation for another church. And it happens regularly. And he gets another church. They don't want to be responsible of putting this guy into driving a taxi cab someplace. And this is the only thing he knows how to do. It's just not honest. It's not, we're talking about Christian integrity. We have it in other kinds of bits of responsibilities. Actually, if I don't think we have to be people of discernment, I mean, with a special gift of discernment, I think we're all required to be discerning. And being discerning still doesn't mean be cynical. It means be spiritually alert. Oh, quite a few years ago, I was in Wheaton, Illinois, and I visited one of the big churches in Wheaton, and it was packed out. And famous Christians and missionaries from all over came to this church. And the speaker was a person who used big words well, and a real gift of speaking. And I was only there one time. You know, I certainly couldn't, it was a sound church. I couldn't fault him on anything he said, and I wasn't trying to. I mean, it was an impressive display of knowledge and intelligence and ability. And I went home to the place where I was staying, and at the dinner table, my host said, Jim, well, what do you think? I had no idea what they wanted me to think, you know. I mean, the place was packed. And I said, I said something, well, he's certainly impressive, but something's wrong. I couldn't fault his grammar, couldn't fault his Bible, couldn't fault his abilities, couldn't fault anything, but something's wrong. A few weeks later, I got a letter from my friend saying that the pastor had been dipping his hand in the till and doing funny things with the money of the church. And when he was caught, he confessed. Half the church wanted him to come back because he's so gifted. And another half the church didn't want him to come back, so split the church. He thought, well, he's repented, he should be forgiven. It's a lack of integrity. Now, can that be forgiven? Yeah, you can be forgiven. The question is, there are places of responsibility. You need men of integrity. Last month and a half, I've been talking with a close Christian friend of mine who is a Major General of the Marine Corps and Commandant of a Marine base. And he anticipated that he was probably not going to get promoted. And he was asked and sorted out of many applicants to be the headmaster of a top prep school in the country in Virginia, a place where one of the Bush boys went, and a very good prep school. And he pretty much, and then he made it. Out of all the applicants, they picked him. And then he found out he was going to make lieutenant general. You get 3 stars. And when I was with him a month ago, he wanted to know how to figure out the will of God. Well, I sure wanted him to stay in the Marine Corps, partly because he is an outstanding Christian, and 3 stars is 3 stars. I mean, when I was a young officer, there used to be a little saying that says, "Twinkle, twinkle, little bar, how I wish you were a star." Okay. Well, anyhow, I tried to be objective as we talked, and I was giving him some sort of hopeful wisdom on how to know the will of God. But I didn't want to say so, but I was leaning toward the Marine Corps rather than this prep school. Well, last week I was over in Bremerton and I wrote him a letter and said the opposite to him. And I got a phone call from him today. He'd called the office and to let me know his decision, but I wasn't home, and to look for somebody who could teach Japanese at the prep school. And could I help him find somebody? But then he told me this afternoon why he took the prep school instead of, and he told the commandant of the Marine Corps that he refused the promotion to lieutenant general. And he said, I've had great peace, but he said the reason for it is that I'd pretty much given my word before to these people when they offered the job to me. And then I got promotion and I was reneging. And I realized and I made a major case of being a Christian to these people at this prep school. And he said it would reflect on Jesus Christ, it would reflect on the Marine Corps, and it would reflect on me. And he didn't use the word integrity, but he said, I told the commandant I didn't want the 3 stars and I was going to the prep school. Okay, that's integrity. It happened quite a few years ago now. A fellow I'd known in Ann Arbor, Michigan, was teaching in eastern Kentucky. And he said, Jim, would you pray? I'd like to come to the community in Moscow, Idaho. Would you pray with me that a math position would open up at the University of Idaho in my field? And he said, I've told the Lord if that happened, I would come to Moscow, Idaho. So, sometime later, he called me again. He said, that math position opened up at Moscow, Idaho, and I got accepted. But he said, also, I want to open up the University of Wyoming at Laramie, and I got accepted. And the University of Wyoming pays more than the one at Idaho. And he said, you do have a bookstore at Laramie too, don't you? He wanted to be in this community. I said, what did you tell the Lord? What did you tell the Lord? No question in my mind, the Wyoming thing is a temptation with more dollars on it to keep you from keeping your word to God. He told me that, he said, the likelihood of a job opening up at the University of Idaho in my field of mathematics is almost, you know, he said, if that happens, I've told the Lord I'd take it. I said, don't call me for counsel. You already made your decision, some time ago. Now, there was, nobody else was involved. It was just, and that's what happens a lot of times. People make commitments, and they don't keep their commitments. Here's another thing. There are Christians who tell lies, and largely because they're asked questions, and they don't think it's the other person's business. So rather than telling the other person it's none of your business, or something similar to that, and it really isn't any of the other person's business, they'll tell them something else. Maybe inane, maybe not serious, maybe not anything. It's just that they don't like to have questions asked, and so they. I remember sitting in a home back in Maryland, talking with this young Christian woman, and she told me she only had a certain amount of time because she had an appointment with a gynecologist at 3 o'clock or something like that. And the telephone rang, and I heard her say this, and she said, I'm sorry, I can't make it. I've got an appointment with the dentist at 3 o'clock, 3 o'clock this afternoon. Now, I don't know who she's lying to, you know? But I suppose it was the other one. You know? So anyhow, I hit her when she got off the phone. Not this kind of hit her, but but some of the people I think need this kind of hitting because Christians have adjusted to, and everybody's doing it bit. You work for a big company, and people steal paper clips. Not one. I mean, not something that you clip your papers together and take home. Not that kind of thing. They need a whole box of paper clips. Now, you know, probably 15 cents or 39 cents or something like that. And the idea is everybody does it, and they won't miss it. Most lack of integrity is not a lack of integrity on big things. It's a lack of integrity on little things. But little things become big things. Here's how it happens in Christian bookstores. Do you know that Christian bookstores have a trouble with integrity? I remember years ago, somebody would order a book. I mean, we can get books very fast now. We can get books in about 4 days. The computer calls Portland, and they put them in the mail. They're here, UPS, end of the week. But whatever it was, I would special order a book, or any of our staff would special order a book, and we'd tell them it'd probably be in 2 weeks. And 2 weeks went by, and the lady would call and said, is my book in yet? Now what happened is, I didn't order it. But she says, it's in yet. And I said, no ma'am, it's not here yet. Okay. Now the reason it's not here, I didn't even order it. Now that's not integrity. That kind of lying, now the fact that I've told you this means that I did confess it a long time ago. If I hadn't confessed it a long time ago, I wouldn't even admit that I did such a thing. But God can make us honest, upright people in the world system. And it's probably the best eye-opener that the rest of the world has when they see that you stand up regardless of what's happening. Comments, questions?
Well, in the case of this church that you visited once, what should the board have done in splitting the church? Should they have accepted his forgiveness and let him continue on in the ministry? Or should he have acquiesced and gone to new pastors?
They should have accepted him back in the fellowship, but not as pastor. They should, if he's been forgiven by God, there's no reason the church shouldn't forgive. Half the church say, no, if you forgive him, then you forgive him as pastor. Unfortunately, when it's also in the newspapers, one of the requirements for an elder in the church, a bishop in 1 Timothy 3, is he has a good reputation among the outsiders. And even if a person is forgiven, how many people in town are going to say, that figures? Now, they won't look and say how forgiving the church is. They'll say how gullible the church is that you want a thief as a pastor. Now, I think he should be restored into complete fellowship, take communion, everything else. But you find out something else with somebody like that, with great gifts, ability to speak, he's too proud not to be in the pulpit. He's got to be an upfront person. He's got to have the attention focused on him. And that tells you something else about him, which you don't notice initially because he's gifted, and you expect gifted people to be upfront. But when they are... Then when something happens and you find out how they take not being up front, what he did, he went with another denomination and started a church across the street. And then said in the newspaper that the reason that they did this is a doctrinal difference with, he didn't hold to the doctrine of the previous church. They did hold to this doctrine difference. Now, he may have changed his doctrine too, you know. But you sense that there's a maybe the other church had a bad attitude. Maybe the church had a bad attitude. I don't know all about it. I just knew I wasn't observing the church. I was observing the pastor with some sort of discernment that something was wrong, that the power of the Holy Spirit wasn't there, just a gifted man was there who happened seemed to agree with the scripture. So generally when there is, how to say it this way, sins don't travel in singles. When there's a major sin that shows up, there have been a lot of little ones prior to the big one showing up that have not been taken care of. I think maybe it was last week we spoke on Psalm 100, well, maybe it'll begin this week, Psalm 100, no, correction, Psalm 19:13, which says, "Keep your servant from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me, then I'll be innocent of great transgression." When great transgression happens, you know that the person hasn't been kept from presumptuous sins. For if he had been kept from presumptuous sins, in a great transgression wouldn't have happened. Now when a great transgression happens and the person is repentant of the great transgression, he may not be repentant of all the presumptuous sins that led him up to the great transgression. So you know that there are a lot of other things that set him up for the big one. And we may not know what they are. So I'm not saying he can never come back in the pastorate. I'm saying that he doesn't automatically come back just because he's repented of the big transgression and forgiven. He should be like the deacons. Let them be tried and examined and see if there's a change. Another place where you see a lack of integrity, I think children see it, again, in missionary homes and in Christian pastors' homes, full-time workers' homes, they see the father talking differently on the telephone than he talks to the children or to his wife. And they see him talking differently in church than he does at home. And they come to a view of hypocrisy, and they reject Christianity because of the father who just has two different tones of voice. This happened many years ago, but the church asked somebody to co-preach with me because I traveled a lot, and they wanted somebody not just to fill in when I was gone, but somebody, you know, side by side. Again, I knew something was wrong. But I thought, well, if I say anything to the, I wasn't in on the calling, the other, I wasn't, had anything to do with it. I was just a substitute myself at the Grange. I substituted for 5 years before, so they just called somebody else to substitute alongside me. I knew something was wrong, but not doctrinally, not, you know, not ability-wise, again. And I didn't want to say anything to the deacons because it looked like I was jealous of the position, so I kept my mouth closed. Then one day, his wife came over to us, to Bessie and me, and just cried and poured out. And I said, well, I'll go speak to your husband. She said, no, don't dare tell you. I came to you, he'd kill me. Well, later on, he took our mission church, went with the mission church, and then he got a job someplace else and left his wife in Moscow. I said, no, your wife's got to go with you. And he said, no, there's no room out there. It's better for her to stay here. Well, he ran off with somebody else's wife. And during all the succeeding years, divorced and married, and then I talked with his children. And the children said that every Sunday morning he berated his wife so badly that she was completely distraught at the breakfast table, that she couldn't go to church, and the church was critical because the pastor's wife never came to church. And then he'd preach at church. I found this afterwards. 10 years went by, 10 or 11 years. We, you know, we brought discipline on him, and the church he is with brought discipline. And they went to see him. I went to see him, confronted him. A year or so ago, we got a, Doug got a letter from Doug Wilson. Said, Doug, 10 years ago, you asked if I was repentant over divorcing my wife. And he said, I want you to know I am. And we restored him to fellowship. He came down and had fellowship with him and his new wife. But I don't, but all these years, he'd been pastoring a church. I don't think he should have been, but that wasn't my, but it was, all the years that he was not repentant, he was pastoring. Just a lack of integrity. Yes?
I think that's really common, a lack of integrity. You know, for instance, when we kind of stir up someone's given us too much change back or something.
Well, we haven't talked on restitution here, but it used to be I'd speak on it at least once a year. And it was like shooting ducks in a barrel. The Christians were thieves. And I'd be lined up afterwards, but this one, we were at Edison School, Franklin School, someplace. This fellow came up to me afterwards, and he said, I got to see you right away. I said, I'm sorry, I can't see you right away. I said, 2 o'clock at my house this afternoon. So he came with his young wife, and he said, I said, what do you want to talk about? He said, what you said this morning. I said, well, wasn't it clear? What's your problem? He said, well, I don't have any money. Or now I'm not sure how he said it. I said, well, you did understand it. He said, yes. I said, then why are you seeing me? He said, well, let me tell you. It's all right. He said, I've got a leather fringe jacket that bothers my conscience every time I see it. I don't wear it anymore. It just hangs in the closet. And then he said, I've got a pair of running shoes I found at the boat races at the Tri-Cities. And they fit me. Somebody had gone wading or something, I suppose. And I've got a basketball from the men's locker room. And I have a bicycle I've had for 10 years from a house in Spokane. And I had 100 tapes, no, 50 tapes, I guess, 50 tapes at $7 a piece. But he said, I don't like that kind of rock music anymore, so I threw them all away. But there was, 50 times 7, 300, maybe 6, I don't know how many, but it was somewhere between 50 and 100 tapes, threw away. And he went on like that. I said, oh, what is your problem? He said, I don't have any money. I said, well, how much money do you have? He said, I have $50. I said, well, what are you and your wife living on? Oh, he said, all that money I earned last summer, I've got it budgeted out for the rest of the year. Well, I said, you do have the money. He looked at me. I said, you don't have to eat. That's not your money. Well, he went out and paid it. Found this address in Spokane and went up. There's a party going on in the house, and he knocked the door, and the man came to the door, and he said, did you lose a bicycle about 10 years ago? You know, father, husband. I don't know. So, but his wife knew, and wife came. So he said, here's $100. She went over the corner and counted it. Okay, now this fella has been walking within the light ever since. But there's one, just to get back to your thing about this one friend of Gordon's from junior high, high school, hung around the house a lot. And one day he told me that some stuff he had stolen. And one of the things he had stolen was a tent from Tri-State. And I said, wait, how did you do that? He said, I just wanted to know if I could walk out the front door with a tent. Okay, and he told me two or three other stories. So I said, listen, you got to take it back. And so a couple months to go by, and I'd say, have you taken it? No, I haven't taken it. A couple months went by. Have you? No. One day he came in the house. I said, let's go. He said, wait, I don't have any money. I said, that's all right, we're going anyhow. So went to Tri-State, asked to see the manager. And I said, sir, this young man has something to tell you. So he told him, it was, I think, $350 tip. And the manager said, oh, you know, everybody does things like that, you know. I think it got to him. He's probably what he did. I don't know. I don't know. But you could tell from his reaction. But he knew he had to act as a manager, and because this would turn in, he said, well, he said, you've got a job. He said, I'll see you Monday. This is on a Friday. I'll see you Monday. I'll pay you $350 an hour. He said, in 100 hours, it'll be paid for. And if you do a good job, you've got a job at the end of that. Come on. Then we went to another store, and it was a grocery store. And he said, I've got $15 worth of stuff. And the manager said, well, that looks like about, you know, 5 hours of work. I'll see you tomorrow. Don't wear your good clothes. And we, you know, that's where we went. And they let him work it off every place. But once you don't do that, I had one fellow who was convicted, gave me a long list of places, including Crossroads Bookstore, where he'd taken the World Vision offering. And I said, okay, I want so much a month, and I'll take it back and pay the places. And he gave it to me for several months. And then he told his father. And his father first got very upset that he'd stolen. His father was an attorney. Really angry that he'd stolen. And then really angry when he found out his son was taking it back. Well, then, this kid is now the city attorney for the same town. Now, in the meantime, the boy came back to me and said, I don't think it's right for me to take things back anymore. I said, okay, here's your list. And he quit making restitution. And he's now the city attorney, prosecuting shoplifters. I don't think he's gone on with the Lord. When you don't have the integrity on little things, it doesn't get any better. Brent.
A number of years ago, I was one of the ducks that you shot in the barrel. And I remember that at the Pizza Haven in Pullman, a friend and I had gone in there and ordered a large pizza and a couple Cokes. And we got out in the car, and I asked him, I said, so how much, this is before I was a Christian. And I said, how much was it? And he says, what are you talking about? And I said, well, how much was it? And he says, you paid. No, I didn't. Well, we sped off. Okay. Well, I went back. I went back to Pizza Haven, and I was talking to the gal at the register. And I said, okay, I need a large pizza, and two large Diet Cokes, and so she started ringing it up. And I said, just don't make it, okay? And she said, what are you talking about? And so I told her. And then she said, oh, well, why are you doing that? And I told her, it's because I became a Christian 3 years ago. And she says, oh, well, just forget it. And I go, what are you talking about? She says, well, I'm not quite sure how to ring it up. And I said, if you don't take this money, you're guilty of shoplifting too.
Well, I don't mind.
I told her, I said, this isn't your money to forgive. You don't own the story. So she went back, got the manager. But it was funny is that her first response was, well, it's more passable. I don't want to mess with it. But the manager came out, was just flabbergasted. You know, he figured out how to put it in the machine or something. But, I've enjoyed my pizza far more since then.
Wait a minute. One of these fellows who was, he was older, and he was a heavy equipment driver for a big construction unit here in the Seattle area. And I'm not sure whether it was a crane operator or some other big thing, but he was a... Anyhow, he realized he wanted to go back to school. So in the springtime, right before summer started, he told the boss, he said, at the end of the summer, at the work period, I want to go back to WSU. So I'm giving you 3 months' notice. So he came and worked the next day, and the boss said, well, since you're coming, not coming back in the fall, why don't you just not come back tomorrow? And fired him. And the guy got so angry that he'd given the boss 3 months' notice. The boss hadn't given him any. So he figured the boss owed him things, so he took a lot of tools with him when he left the next day. A lot of metal tools. White came back to WSU, showed up at the church, and sometime in that semester got hit with restitution. So he went home at Christmas time and gathered up all the tools and was driving down to the construction place and had the Christian radio station on. And the Christian, whoever was on the Christian radio station, he said, you may think that you are to make restitution, but that's all Old Testament. That's not New Testament at all. And you don't have to make restitution because it's all under the blood. It's all forgiven. It's all grace. And the guy said, boy, saved by the bell. And turned around, went home, and got an engraving tool and put his initials on all these tools. And was there for the next year, for the next annual event of restitution. Got hit again, and this time he had to take him back with his initials. All right. Well, what happens is that we can get in a habit of being honest. We can choose to, well, I mentioned Ezra yesterday, but I mentioned Daniel. It says, Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the king's meat. Okay, that's where it takes. Purpose in your heart. The NIV says resolved. It's not just making a vow or like a marriage vow, but you make this purpose in your heart, which is a vow, not to sin in this area. Now you say, okay, suppose I violate it. When you make those kind of purposes in your heart, you are much less likely to violate than if you just go along and wait till the temptation comes up. When you can make advanced decisions for future temptations. But if you wait and go with the flow and wait to say, well, I'll decide what to do when I get tempted, I'll tell you right now what the decision will be. But if you purpose in your heart, you're going to be a person of integrity. Okay, let's thank God. Father in heaven, we thank you very much that you've given us grace and forgiveness and grace to obey. We pray that you would help us purpose in our heart to do future decisions your way. In his name we pray, amen.